Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 55, recorded May 30th, 2012. Rob Reed. Triangulation is brought to you by GoToAssist. Working in IT can be complicated. With GoToAssist from Citrix, you can take control of your IT world from one simple cloud-based platform. Provide live or unattended support to all your users anywhere. Sign up for your free 30-day trial right now at GoToAssist.com. Click the Try It Free button and use the offer code TRIANGULATION. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desktop. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click the radio microphone, and use the offer code TRIANGULATION. It's time for Triangulation, my friends. There are three. There can be only three. Tom Merritt is here with me to talk to somebody who is fascinating in so many ways. I don't even know where to begin. A book author, an entrepreneur, a founder, entertainer. If you saw his TED talk about copyright math, Rob Reed is here. And also the luckiest man in America, or Amercia, Mitt Romney would have. I'm going to call him Milt Romney, would have it, because he's married to Morgan Webb, who we all know as the host of X-Play on G4. It's great to have you, Rob.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm interested. I didn't realize this is your third novel, and one of them was called Year One. So the play, Year Zero, I get it now.
Yeah, actually, it's my third book, but first novel. So this is a major departure for me. My first two books were both business books.
Right.
And Year One was basically a first-person memoir of the first year at Harvard Business School, which a topic I was once an expert in. And Year Zero, it is kind of like a little self-referential, obviously. There's no connection between the two books, needless to say. There weren't any aliens at Harvard that I knew about. But I couldn't come up with a working title for this. And I was the prologue starts with mention of this moment called Year Zero.
Right.
And I sort of playfully gave the prologue the title Year Zero. And then I later realized this would be kind of a fun name for the book.
I've used that name.
Resonates. Year One, you wrote while you were at Harvard?
I wrote while I was there. I wrote it during the first
year. Year Zero has a protagonist who is a copyright lawyer.
Yes.
Who has interspace adventures.
Yes.
Did you write it while having space adventures?
I'm not a copyright lawyer.
Okay, there we go. That's
the key
difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
They say all first novels are autobiographical.
Not this one.
This one clearly is not.
Although some of your musical taste may have leaked into it.
Quite a few of them would have leaked into there.
The premise of this is hysterical. What is the premise of this?
The premise is that a vast alien civilization that spans the entire universe is so into American pop music that it inadvertently commits the biggest copyright infringement since the Big Bang, thereby bankrupting the entire universe, comma. All the wealth in the universe is now owed to us and to our record labels, semicolon.
Thank you.
We humans don't know it yet.
How do we collect is the question. Let me read from the first paragraph of the prologue, which you tell me was kind of the pilot for the book.
It was kind of the pilot.
Aliens suck at music. Now, by the way, John Hodgman will be reading this for Audible.com.
He is reading it for
so
Audible.
So please do not judge. Aliens, I can't wait to hear him read this, suck at music. And it's not for lack of trying. They've been at it for eons, but have yet to produce even a faintly decent tune. If they had, we'd have detected them ages ago. We've been scanning the skies for signs of intelligent life for generations, after all. And we have actually picked up thousands of alien anthems, slow dances, and ballads. But the music's so awful that it's always mistaken for the death rattle of a distant star. It's seriously that bad.
It's gamma ray bursts.
It's awful, yeah.
Wow.
Gamma ray bursts are rather tuneful compared to this alien music, which they have spent billions of years perfecting, and they really have a long way to go.
And any prologue that mentions Welcome Back, Cotter, Boogie Oogie Oogie by the Taste of Honey, Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks, and
joy,
Staying
fun.
Alive. Joy to the World.
Joy, fun, Seasons in the Sun.
We had joy. You know, that was written by, who was that written by?
Well, the singer's Terry Jacks.
But Rod McEwen wrote the...
Is that right?
I think so.
Really?
For some reason, I think so.
But anyway, that could be just my brain.
Now, just so the listeners at home or the viewers at home don't think that this book is entirely about the 70s, the reason that those particular songs are in the prologue is because the aliens discover us in 1977.
Uh-huh.
Those are among the first songs that they pick up.
And even then, they still loved our music. Impressive.
It is impressive. Yeah, despite what they found first. Exactly.
Now, this is very Douglas Adams-like, by the way.
Thank you.
I don't mean to damn you with the high comparison for anybody who reads it, because that's such a huge comparison, but I definitely had that flavor when I was reading this. And
tongue-in-cheek, dry, witty, funny.
What I loved about it is that you combine an incredibly relevant current premise, which is, hey, you know, our copyright laws are so messed up that if all aliens decided to respect our laws the way we say, oh, if we find new cultures, we must respect their laws, that they would then owe us all this money.
Yes.
But then you also create the aliens to be superior in every way except
for music.
Except for music, which is key to this. How did you go about saying, I mean, it's kind of a parable that you wanted to give this message about the copyright law and yet dress it up in such a fun way that it doesn't feel like you're swallowing a pill?
Yeah, well, so basically I set out to create, in the eyes of the reader, the mind of the reader, two equally silly, preposterous, impossible to believe, clearly sarcastic and farcical worlds. On the one hand, we have our music-addled aliens, and then on the other hand, we have the record labels and their incestuous relationship with our political system. And so, but everything, I've been pretty determined to make everything in the political human record label world 100% accurate, or very close to that. And the alien world is largely made up. And so hopefully the readers will not, like you said, it isn't meant to be like swallowing a pill. It is a very playful book. If you have no interest in copyright law, it's not going to interfere with your enjoyment of the book. But I think that a lot of readers will be like, oh, this is really funny, this kind of caricature of Washington that he's portraying. It's really like that. And that's what's fun about it.
Well, yeah, that's the, I mean, when you talk about, well, the Geneva Accords, you
the
know.
The Berne Convention.
The Berne Convention.
Yes, the Geneva Accords are the ones that prevent prisoners from being tortured. And by the way, if you were to play even a snippet of this horrible alien music
that would
for
be torture.
A POW,
that
would
be
probably be jailed for life under the Geneva Accords.
Or Terry Jack's Season in the Sun,
that's
I think.
True. The fact that they liked that tells you how very, very desperate they were.
I think
when
it's
they
the
first
same
discovered us.
Music we used to drive Noriega out of his palace during the Nicaragua.
I think Seasons in the Sun would have gotten me to choose a Supermax prison over my palace.
But you work at things like the Berne Convention in a way that's entirely seamless, and I can't even remember what it is, but I still enjoyed the book.
It's the thing that's in there so that people like Larry Lessig will read it and not say Rob was just off.
So,
and
but
actually,
you think
Lessig was a great help. He answered
really?
A lot.
Did he
advise
he helped,
you? Yeah, I asked him piles of questions at different points of writing the book, and he was wonderful.
So do you think you'd come out of this with a better understanding of the music industry and the copyright laws?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just unwittingly, without even knowing.
Without knowing, yeah. It's, you know, kind of like, I mean, this is, I don't want to make it sound like I'm comparing myself to a very, very well-known author, but I will anyway.
I did it
so
first.
Tom Clancy does a lot of research.
Yes.
And other people like
that. And that's
that
one of the things that's interesting about it. You
precisely.
Feel like you're learning a lot about military, you know, arcana from reading a Clancy
and
novel.
And that's part of the power of his writing, is part of the power of many authors in that genre, is there is rigorous research that goes behind the story. So as you are enjoying the story, you learn certain things about Cold War dynamics, weapon systems, war on terrorism, etc. This is all real.
You may not have had to do a lot of research because you founded Listen.com.
I did.
So just to get you up to that point, you were you said you went to Stanford, you studied Arabic and international relations.
Yes.
Good combination. Then Harvard Business School, wrote the book.
Yep.
Then came to Silicon Valley, worked at Silicon Graphics.
I did.
For a while.
A wonderful moment in that company's history.
The 90s,
incredible time.
And no kidding.
We had a stunning group of people there, unbelievable talent, and that diaspora, the people who worked at Silicon Graphics in the mid-90s,
huge.
Is just, it's like an alumni network.
Yeah.
People have gone on to do unbelievable things.
Yeah. We had an Onyx.
Oh, good.
At MSNBC. Yeah. That's how I was my the 3D character Dev Null. I was animated by an Onyx
computer. Was still kicking around at ZDTV later.
The Onyx survived?
Yeah, it was up computer. There in York Street.
$500,000 computer that has about half the power of this laptop.
But, probably, yeah.
But it was
it's all
cool.
about timing. The Onyx's timing was very good.
It was very
to have
cool.
that kind of power in the mid-90s was rather awesome.
So tell me about Listen.com. What, first of all, how did you decide to become an entrepreneur and why Listen.com?
Well, I wrote a book, my second book, which was called Architects of the Web. And that was more of a true business book, I'd say, than year one, which was more memoir. And that basically chronicled the rise of the internet as a commercial medium. And so what happened was I got out of school, came out to Silicon Valley, landed at Silicon Graphics, and our founder took off to start Netscape. And so by kind of, you know, sort of random chance, I ended up becoming the business development interface between SGI and Netscape. So I became an internet... Jim Clark, precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I became an internet full-timer in 1994, 95. So very, early. Very early. And I had just had this really fun and unusual experience of writing a book. And as I got more and more excited about everything that I was learning and seeing about the internet, I felt like I'd really like to write a book about this. I'd like to sit down and spend, you know, 8 months in an ivory tower doing nothing but thinking and writing about this and talking to everybody who's doing anything remotely interesting.
Because you could see something was really happening.
Oh, man. It was very, very exciting. So I did that. Finished, became a venture capitalist for a couple of years, but as a result of having written the book, I'd gotten to know a lot of really, really talented and inspiring entrepreneurs. The book was basically structured around entrepreneurial stories.
Now, going from being an author to a venture capitalist is not normal progress?
No, it's very abnormal.
So how did you make that jump?
I think it was that the author thing, well, it fed in for a couple of reasons. I was an MBA. I'd been working in the Valley. I had kind of the normal beginnings of a venture capital career trajectory. And then the writing of the book, I did it because I was intrigued by it. In retrospect, I wish I'd had this foresight and could claim this foresight, but it was a very good career move in that I did get to know everybody who was doing anything interesting on the early internet. And at that moment, late 96, early 97 when I'm finishing the book, there was very little internet expertise in the venture firms because the commercial internet was 18, 24 months old, something like that. Even the junior folks, even the associates, had generally been in their jobs for 2 or 3 years. There were very few people had any operating history at all. In fact, there may not have been anybody with operating experience in the internet at that time. And although mine was limited, I was working for a big computer company and interfacing with an internet company. It was more than most folks had. And by having written this book, I knew a lot of folks.
You knew Halsey and Shelby from CNET, Mark Andreessen from Netscape, Jerry Yang, founder of Yahoo.
Yeah, it was a really...
Rob Glaser
of Real Networks, all these folks. Basically, I structured the book around profiles of 8 entrepreneurs and their companies and used that as a mechanism to talk about different aspects of the internet that were important. Search engines in the case of Yahoo, streaming audio in the case of Real Networks, magazines colliding with the internet in the case of Wired Magazine and Hotwired. So that was kind of like a good expertise base. Became a VC and did it for 2 years, but throughout that whole period, I continued to be in touch with my entrepreneurial buddies and really felt like that was like the thing I wanted to do.
You didn't want to give the money, you wanted to spend the
money. I wanted to receive it, exactly. just the way I approached
Christmas. But you didn't bring in these founders to join you. You did this all by... You did listen
to... Oh, yeah, I was a sole founder, yes.
And why? That's an interesting choice.
I had seen at that point, as a VC, I'd gone through hundreds of business plans and met with many dozens of companies, and I had seen co-founder situations blow a company up more than I'd seen it make a company greater.
Now, Paul Graham told me, he said, you shouldn't be doing this on your own. You really should have a co-founder.
when it works, you look in retrospect and whatever you did was
the right thing.
Clearly seems like the right thing. But what I had seen in a lot of cases, I mean, when a co-founder situation works great, there's nothing better. I mean, Dave and Jerry at Yahoo, Larry and Sergey at Google, there are many, many famous examples and famous stories, and we see those, and we see this great synergy of two talented people, and we assume, like, well, that's the way to do it. What you don't see is the ones that blow up along the way. And if there is a co-founder relationship that's not working, it is very hard for a company to survive that.
Yeah.
And what's worse is when there's lots of co-founders. There was the communal love capital structure, which would happen when 4 or 5 buddies would start a company together and they'd all own equal amounts.
Oof.
And lo and behold, 6, 7, 8 months into it, there were, you know, two people maybe who were pulling their weight, and now you've got, right, you know, 40, 50, 60% of equity that's kind of gone MIA.
Right.
You know, I'd seen founder situations be potentially very destructive. And when they worked because there were two people who were already very dialed into each other, in my experience. And I didn't have somebody like that who I felt like, you know, would be like a yin and yang sort of compliment to me. So I started it on my own,
or
and that turned out to be
yang.
Fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to find out
Philo and Yang, yeah, yes,
what the elevator pitch was for Listen.com in just a moment. We're talking to Rob Reed. And I'll also talk about your TED Talk, which was great copyright
Thank
math.
Thank you.
Boy, was that funny. And if the book, now I haven't read the book because Tom stole the one and only copy. Well, now there's a second one now because they've multiplied. But originally there was but one. And so Tom has read it. And I know liked it a lot,
I loved
right?
It, yeah.
In fact, Rob is going to be on Sword and Laser later in July.
Yep. I am. I'm looking forward to it.
And the book comes out. We should say we've been plugging the book, but it's not out yet. So don't run to the bookstore. July 10th.
Run to the bookstore and pre-order.
It
you
is
could
pre-order.
On
it
Amazon?
It is pre-orderable, yes.
Year Zero. Rob Reed. We'll talk more about that and listen.com in a bit, but first a word from our fine sponsor, Citrix, and Go to Assist. We have been talking about Go to Assist for a long time as a remote access product. Beep, scratch that. It still has the rate remote access. They acquired a company, and they have added a new feature that is going to transform how you do your business. If you're in IT, especially if you want to be in managed support, this is incredible. Go to Assist has now added remote monitoring, but that sounds like a little thing. It's a huge thing. When you install the remote monitoring and Go to Assist, it goes out, it crawls the network, it finds every bit of hardware, every bit of software, every network peripheral running, gives you an incredible dashboard, and now you can proactively monitor the health of every bit of your system. You can, for instance, if servers are running poorly, you know before your clients do. If their Wi-Fi is bogging down, you know. If the toner cartridge is running out, you know. You will look like a support hero because nothing ever goes wrong with your client's stuff because you know ahead of time. It really is incredible. We gave it to Russell Tammany, our IT guy. He's actually a contractor for us. We only have him a few hours a week. He has 855 different clients, including us. And he's been using it, and he just loves it. It's about a quarter of the cost of the tool he's been using. He says it's incredible. If you're in the IT business, if you'd like to grow your IT business, you want to know more. Actually, I use Go to Assist, kind of a trivial way to kind of help my mom with her computer. And you could still do that. But there's now so much more. We have it set up. All the servers in the basement, you know, what happened is I'd get a tweet in the middle of the night. Somebody'd say, your server's down. I'd get on the phone. I'd call John. I'd say, the server's down. John would have to get up, walk over here, go in. Not anymore. I log in. I can fix anything. It is incredible. I want you to check it out. Go to assist.com. You can try it free for 30 days, including the new monitoring features. The whole kit and caboodle, absolutely free. But you do need to use the offer code triangulation. So visit gotoassist.com. Click that promo code field there once you say the try it free, you know, promo, and make sure you put in triangulation so we get credit for that. Of course, Citrix is the trusted. Yeah, just go ahead and show them. Scroll down a little bit because it's new now. Yeah, there it is. And then see at the bottom it says promo code. You just click that right above the continue button. Don't forget to do that and put triangulation in there. Citrix is the trusted leader in IT. They've been doing this better than anybody. In fact, you know what? Go to Assist is 10 years old now. It's their 10th year.
So
as a cloud-based platform. It's so cute. It's a 10-year-old now. And actually, they're going to celebrate by giving away 10 Android tablets, Galaxy Tabs. Just visit Facebook and like the Go to Assist page for your chance to win one of 10 Galaxy Tabs. Go to assist.com and on Facebook, Go to Assist. It's a great product. We've been very happy using that. And Russell, I got to get him a deal. He wants to use it.
He loved it.
He did. He
was
really did.
He was like, yeah.
He was really liking
it. Really
it.
Was.
And in fact, he's working with it. It's kind of neat because he said, but there's a couple of things. And they said, well, good, tell us. And so, you know, pretty soon you're going to get the Russell Tammany edition.
Signature edition.
Signature edition of Go to Assist. So what was the, Listen.com was your first startup.
Yes.
What was the elevator pitch?
The elevator pitch for Listen was the internet is about to become music ready. Bandwidth is getting fast enough.
Well, you were prescient.
Bandwidth is getting fast enough.
And what year was this again?
This was 99.
Okay.
Bandwidth is getting fast enough. Hard drives are getting big enough. And the first MP3 players have just shipped, and that's game-changing because it makes the media portable.
This is before the iPod. It didn't come out until two years later.
Oh, yeah, the iPod was actually four. iPod came out in April of 2003.
Oh, is it that long?
That late. Actually, no, excuse me. That was when the 01. iTunes store launched.
It was 01.
Yeah,
it was
like
iPod.
A year and a half prior to that. Yep. The store launched in April of 2003.
Right.
So basically,
so was Listen selling music? What was Listen doing?
Well, Listen was basically, as it turned out, we were in the business of pleading for licenses for 3 years, which was really not the original intention. But the labels made this catastrophic decision, which was to try to embargo their product from the internet.
Napster had already happened, and people were robbing the blind.
Napster had not yet happened when I started the company.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. It did launch.
Okay.
It launched about 6 months after I started the company, and maybe a month or so after I launched.
Did you shake your fist at him a little bit? Because here you are trying to do the licenses.
And they're giving it away.
And play by the rules.
It was a very tense couple of years.
Yeah.
It was a very, very tense couple of years.
If it hadn't been for Napster, the music industry may never have softened their position.
Well,
right?
If it hadn't been for Napster, it would have been something else. I mean,
right.
Basically, so the problem, the mistake that the music labels made, or that the record industry made, is with the launch of the first MP3 player, the internet was, in fact, music ready.
Right.
And had they, and obviously hindsight's 20/20, but nonetheless, had they launched a wonderful sanctioned service fairly quickly, the first experience that everybody in the world would have had with digital music would have been a legal, licensed, sanctioned experience. Now, actually, I'll pitch my article if that's okay.
Yeah.
I have a big piece that is hopefully going to run, probably going to run unless something, you know, goes wrong in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, where I'm going to compare the rates of piracy in electronic books versus music. And I think that the difference is dramatic.
Because electronic books had a legal forum right off the bat.
Precisely. And that to me is the original sin of the music industry and the world of music piracy. Look at books. The day that digital media became portable in books, it was with the release of the Kindle. And you had very exciting hardware for the time. We've got more exciting hardware now, but you had exciting hardware. You had a critical mass of content because all six major publishers licensed everything they could. Over 90% of the bestsellers of the day were available the day the Kindle shipped. So you have cutting-edge hardware, fabulous content. You've got Amazon's immaculate retail sensibilities. You've got integrated, seamless national wireless access, all in this beautiful package. And that was the American consumer, the world consumer's first experience with electronic books. Why would you go, and all at a very fair price, why would you go from that to a low-rent piracy experience?
The answer is
relatively few people have. Now, there are a lot of piratable titles on the internet. There's millions. And they get downloaded.
You could probably already get year zero on the internet.
I'll bet you can.
Absolutely.
I've been afraid to look.
But who cares?
Right.
Because, and this is a very important point, I think the music industry just assumes people are naturally thieves.
Yes.
Thieves. And in fact, people want to pay for content. You have to let them.
Right.
Can you imagine if the iPod had launched with the iTunes Store?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Game over.
Because that's what you're describing with the Kindle. That's exactly what it was like.
The iTunes Store launched, I believe, in April of 2003. That was almost 5 years after the first mass market MP3 player shipped. And this is the other thing that's critical. Do you know what the RAAA did, the Recording Industry Association of America, when the first MP3 player shipped? They sued.
They sued Diamond.
They sued Diamond Multimedia.
They almost put them out of business.
They almost did. And so if the RAAA...
And they got the publishers that sued Rocketbook.
Yeah. exactly. And so what the record industry quite literally tried to ban the MP3 player, along with the Switchblade, amongst sort of pocket consumer goods in this country. They failed, thank God. And can you imagine if they had succeeded in getting a government ban, the whole train of innovations and products that led to the iPhone and the iPad would never have happened. So this was the original sin, I think, of the music labels.
Did you sense this, though, when you were talking to them as Listen.com, that these guys were intransigent and didn't get it?
Oh, gosh, yes. But not when I founded the company. So getting back to what I thought I was going to do when I started the company.
You didn't realize it, or you probably wouldn't have started the company. You would have started Napster.
I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
So when I started the company, I'd never had worked with the music industry before. I knew a lot about the internet and high tech. I knew that this was coming. And looking as a rabid, rabid lifelong music fan, I still have 1,000 vinyl records that I'm very loyal to. They're just furniture at this point, admittedly.
You still have a turntable, I hope.
Gosh, yes.
Okay.
But as a rabid music fan going all the way back to childhood, I was like, look, these guys have gone through three speeds of vinyl, 8-track tape, cassette, CD, Internet's a new format. It's a matter of time, probably not a whole lot of time. You know, I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but it's going to be soonish. And, oh, my God, you know, if I'd known about Napster and I didn't when I started the company, didn't exist yet, I'd say, well, that'll just goad them to do it all the quicker. Never occurred to me that it would take 3 years to get licenses. It did. And so while we were patiently pleading,
why? Wait a minute. Why, though?
Because
you when you just put it that way, and I'm sure that's exactly the pitch, hey, this is just the next format.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't hold, if cassettes came along, you wouldn't say, well, we're not going to do cassettes. We got 8 tracks. They wouldn't do that. So why is it they didn't get it?
They decided, well, actually, there's an interesting story. They did fight the CD tooth and nail. That was a brawl inside the music
industry.
Really?
And why was that? Because it was copyable?
It was because it was intercompany politics, because, like, you know, like
Philips came out with it in, what, 79 or 80?
There was all kinds of, you know, this label's in, this label's out, you know, kind of like what we've seen with some video standards, you know, like with the DVD early on and so forth. So the Blu-ray battle and so forth.
So it isn't a given that they're just going to go, oh, great, here's the new format. We can sell all of those old records once more.
Well, you know, it's a given. I thought that it was. And
should
I was
be.
Now, the answer is they did this crazy irrational thing that, thank God for us writers, the publishers did not do. They saw this new medium. They saw a ravenous appetite, consumer appetite for portable music downloads. And they embargoed the market. They embargoed consumer demand. They basically gave piracy a 5-year monopoly on awesome. And don't ever do that. Do not ever.
Probably because they were afraid of piracy, though, right? I mean,
but they ended up enabling it.
Right.
That's the issue.
They said these digital copies, these digital records are so easy to copy, we don't want to make them digital.
Right. Well, then why did you release the CD?
If you never release the CD from the warehouse, nobody can copy it.
Right.
That was the mentality. The problem is with digital copies, it only takes one.
And then it's done.
One CD out of the warehouse, and all of them have left.
But what they missed was that the best way to fight piracy is to create a far better experience at a fair price that people will choose over piracy. And that's what's happened in books. Now, lots of books get downloaded illicitly, but if you look at the industry's statistics, basically the publishing industry has barely shrunk at all. And to the extent that it has, I think it's attributable to the recession and the financial crisis. I mean, publishing is flat to slightly down in the 4.5 years since the Kindle release.
Now, and lots of businesses that aren't affected by piracy are down a lot more.
Are down
than
a hell
that.
Of a lot more, precisely. And so what this tells us is those titles that are being pirated on the internet, book titles, are probably not foregone sales. They're probably not purchases that didn't happen. Those are probably downloads by people who either couldn't have afforded to or wouldn't have bothered to, or who knows what. And, you know, maybe I'm a little bit crazy, but I think that's great. You know, if somebody who would not have bought that otherwise gets access to it and it's not a foregone sale, but your words and your ideas are getting out a little bit further, you know, you can certainly debate whether that's such a terrible thing, but nonetheless.
That's why Cory Doctorow gives his books away.
Precisely.
He's like, forget piracy, just take it.
And it's why Tim O'Reilly doesn't put DRM on any of the O'Reilly publication titles, and he seems to be doing quite well. So in any event, what the publishers did is they said, we are going to make this much better than piracy experience available. The labels looked at the unbelievable advantages of portable music downloads, and they said, de facto, we are going to give piracy a monopoly on this amazing consumer experience.
Crazy.
Why do you think it is that the publishers have learned from that, or at least seem to have learned from that, and video and the movie industry hasn't? Because they seem to be making all the same mistakes all over again.
Well, I think publishing is a very brainy industry, first of all. It's really fascinating. You get on sort of the discussion boards and the email lists that are frequented by the publishing industry. The quality of analysis, the level of thought, the level of thoughtfulness is just, it's amazing. It's like the PBS of business. They're very smart, passionate people who care a great deal because book people are brainy people. So I think that's part of it. I think that there's a level of thoughtfulness that's just present in this very scholarly trade. There's also this very, you know, I don't want to use a gender bias word, but very gentlemanly, to use an old world term.
Courtly.
Very courtly. That's a much better term.
Yeah.
Aspect to the publishing industry. My first two books, Year One and Architects of the Web, went out of print. And so what the publishers did is they basically gave me my rights back. I can't imagine.
That is courtly.
It's very courtly. And I can't imagine that. And so I'm actually going to put year one, the Harvard book, I'm going to put that back into print.
Oh, good.
As an experiment in self-publishing.
As an e-book.
Yeah, as an e-book. Yeah. And also as a print-on-demand book.
Nice.
Later this summer. So I'm not sure exactly
when. I want to read The Architects of the Web, too.
That's my next
project. I would
project.
Love to see that. That's historic now.
It is. And I have, actually, in connection to that mission history, I have hundreds of hours of tapes. Because I interviewed hundreds of hours with Kim Pelosi,
Would
Jerry
you
Yang.
Release that?
Well, yes, I want to, and I intend to. I'd like to put it up online or
get
give
permission?
It to Smithsonian.
Put them on archive.org.
Is that where I should put
it?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you want to give it away, it's public domain. Yeah, absolutely.
Archive.org. Just upload it to archive.
They'll host it.
Brewster Kahle would love to have it.
Okay, good.
Kim
Pelosi
was at Java. She was one of the original marketers of Java.
Co-founded Marimba.
And then she did Marimba. Yes. Yeah. Who else do you have?
I've got Jerry Yang.
Jerry Yang would be fascinating, especially now
in
light
of
what's happened.
Oh, precisely. And also with all of these companies, have lots of executives in the companies as well. So I interviewed Jerry Yang and lots of people at Yahoo.
This is an important historic document.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
You were right in the sense that there's something happening here.
Yeah.
Let's document this.
Yeah, and I paid for a woman to type most of these interviews up,
but
the much more interesting is the audio.
Yeah.
And so I have hundreds of hours, not just Rob Glaser, but lots of people, what was then called Progressive Networks, not just Halsey Miner, but lots of people at CNET, not just Andrew Anker, but lots of people at Wired.
That'd be great.
And it's really fun stuff.
That'd be great. I'd love to hear all that. I would love, and we lived through it, but I'd still love to hear.
Well, I'm inspired. Oh, yeah. This will be my next project.
This was the plan for Tech TV, was to document the transformation the revolution that's happening. It was a failed plan, but it was the plan.
It was a noble plan.
It worked for a few years.
It was a noble
thought.
Yes.
We documented the downturn, the bust, really well.
We did document the bust.
Lots of layoffs.
And the Microsoft DOJ lawsuits.
Yeah.
You turned Listen.com into Rhapsody. What happened there?
Eventually, we got the licenses we were seeking. Before then, we created a whole bunch of information products. So we had a directory of all the legally available downloads online. We licensed data from, concert data.
So you were I remember this now.
Yeah.
You were kind of a search engine
kind
for
music.
Kind
of like InfoSpace. Yeah. So what we did is we created a searchable directory of all the legally available music online, which was very interesting until Napster launched, because the legally available music then became a very, very nerdy subset of what people were actually interested in. So at that point, to use a modern term, we pivoted, and we started doing a lot of information services, not unlike InfoSpace, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we licensed in a lot of different data sources, and we would create basically an architecture of data where you could get, concert listings, discography information, artist photographs, et cetera. And we ended up licensing that out to all of the major search engines. So we were powering essentially the music search on Yahoo, Excite, InfoSeek, AltaVista.
Good business.
It was a good business. It was a great way to keep the lights on until the licenses came down the pike, which finally happened.
It's funny because that's what now Google's going back to with Knowledge Graph is going out to outside canonical sources and saying, what is the true history of this or that. That's very interesting.
Just real quickly, what led to getting the licenses? Was it just perseverance was there a change of mind?
It was, I think, a few things. It was perseverance on our part. It was a dawning realization at the labels that the embargo wasn't working.
Napster.
The embargo of their product from the world. I mean, it was long after Napster shut down that they licensed the iTunes Music Store. Oh, yeah. They didn't. Even just because Napster shut down didn't mean the labels were going to jump into the breach and fill this vacuum with legal product.
Opportunity after opportunity.
Oh, yeah, missed. Napster shuts down. Labels continue to embargo their product from their ravenous consumers.
They said, we won!
Yeah,
right? Have a cigar!
How else do you think Kazaa got so big so fast?
Right.
Because there was nothing else that was launched.
There was a power vacuum. Right.
So I think actually the other thing that's important is there was a Department of Justice investigation of the record labels. So what had happened is they had started these two companies called MusicNet and PressPlay.
Mm. Oh, yes.
Two of the five majors, Sony and Universal, were behind PressPlay, and the other three, Warner, BMG, and EMI, were behind MusicNet.
Problem number one. Full catalog not available on either.
Well, that's a big problem. But there was a widespread perception in the industry that the master plan was to cross-license the catalogs, and then you would have precisely two companies peddling music online, and oh my God, they'd be owned by the record labels. DOJ didn't like that. And they started an investigation into the situation. There were never any, public results of that investigation, but I believe that the existence of it was inspiring perhaps, to some in the industry.
Maybe we need a third party.
It might have given them the notion that perhaps we should license to others as well. And we were like kind of the nerdy people with the white hats on by the punch bowl at the party. All the really cool kids were having fun. They're like, okay, that guy. And Rhapsody actually was the first company, or the first service, Listen.com was the first company, to get all five major label licenses before actually Press Play or MusicNet. Again, my guess is I'd like to think it was our brilliant negotiating acumen and charisma and charm and good looks, but I'm sure it was a lot of window dressing. But we took those licenses, we ran with it.
Onerous were they? I mean, you know, you hear stories about Apple and how it had to make deals. And so, how difficult was this?
Horrifyingly difficult. That's why, I mean, it really was a three-year conversation, de facto. It stopped and started. You know, it's kind of like the six-party talks in North Korea. It just never ended.
Did all the money from the search stuff go into this to kind of keep this going? I mean...
Oh, this was our... We shut it. When Rhapsody launched, we bet the company on it. Yeah. We actually shut the other stuff down.
Yeah. It funded it. It funded the three-year...
It kept our lights on.
Yeah.
It definitely kept the lights on.
Yeah. And Rhapsody, how long? And Rhapsody's still around, by the way. If you go to Rhapsody.com, it's owned by Real Networks.
Well, Real Networks bought it. So I sold the company in 03. Real Networks bought it. And then I think, I want to say it was in 05 or maybe 06, that they sold half of Rhapsody to MTV. And Rhapsody's grown a lot as a result of that, because it gets a lot of basically free advertising on MTV. It's grown substantially over the years. It's now, of course, it's smaller than iTunes. I believe it's got to be smaller than Spotify in the U.S. at this point, because Spotify is giving its service away, and you can do well with that.
Yeah.
But Rhapsody has, they publicly stated...
Depending on your definition of do well, of course.
You can certainly get a lot of customers. But Rhapsody has over a million subscribers, according to what they've announced publicly. They bought, at the end of last year, they bought Napster. So Napster, it wasn't really the Napster
It wasn't
company.
The same Napster.
It was just the brand.
Right.
Yeah.
So you, in a way, you own Napster.
No, because I sold Rhapsody.
I love it. Well, and it's funny because Rhapsody now has been a little bit eclipsed by Mog and RDO, ironically, by the guys who did Kazaa. And Spotify, particularly Spotify.
I'll be a Rhapsody loyalist for a moment and say I'm pretty sure that Rhapsody is orders of magnitude larger than Mog or RDO.
In terms of subscriber
paying,
base.
Paying subscribers.
Paying subscribers.
Yeah.
Well, Samsung's launching this music hub now to do exactly the same thing. And in most cases, it's the same 19 million or whatever songs, right? Everybody's got the same library now.
Yeah.
The music industry's finally got that.
Yes. They have.
Although still not all the songs.
Not the Beatles.
In the library.
The Beatles haven't got it.
Yeah.
But everybody else.
And the labels, I've trashed them enough. I mean, to their credit, they had a lot of lunatic artist managers and agents and artists slowing them down in a lot of cases.
That's interesting.
There were a lot of cases in which the labels didn't have the freedom to license on certain artist-by-artist basis.
Well, and look, the holdouts were Metallica and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. There were these individual holdouts, which apparently Steve Jobs had to one-by-one mow down.
And the Walter Isaacs book does a very good job of talking about that negotiation, how it went down and so forth. I mean, it's, you know, it was a very, very long conversation, like I said.
I want to talk about copyright math.
Yes, let's talk about copyright math.
In just a little bit. We're talking with Rob Reed. His new book, which we'll talk more about, Year Zero, is coming out July 10th. You can like it on Facebook. You can read about it on the website, which is readrobreed.com.
And that site, by the way, launches on Friday.
Ah, so
right
be
now
some,
it's a splash page.
But there's going to be lots more there.
The full site's going to launch on Friday.
And it is a good place to see the $8 billion iPod.
Yes, the copyright math talk is there.
There are already reviews on Goodreads, though.
There are.
Somebody named Tom Merritt reviewed it.
I know.
Yeah.
What
did he like it?
How did he get a hold of it earlier?
He seems to have liked it, that guy.
I did.
I'm very excited about that.
By the way, Old Geek in our chat room says, Twitch show idea, Reed's archive of internet history in first person. Wouldn't that be great? He said, let me tell you about the time I sat down and talked. Let me tell you about Halsey Miner.
Oh, hey, Jerry Yang was just a whippersnapper when I met him.
It was just Jerry Y.
Jerry Y, we called him.
So, yeah, the copyright math talk was a lot of fun.
We'll talk about it in just a sec. Yeah. But first, this word. Here's a business idea that would have been a good one to have a few years ago. I wish I'd had it. Stamps.com. They, you know, here's the elevator pitch. Forget postage meters. Forget going to the post office. You know, people have computers, they have printers. Why can't they print postage? And everybody would say, no, you can't do that. The post office would never go, yes, they did. And that's how Stamps.com was born almost 10 years ago now. And it is the best way right now to avoid going to the post office ever again. Bring the post office to your desk. You don't need special inks. You don't need a postage meter. You just need a Mac or a PC, a printer, and Stamps.com. In fact, when you sign up, and I'm going to tell you how you can do this, a really great introductory offer. You'll get a USB scale that you plug into the computer, so you just plop the letter or the package down on there. You can see it prints right on the envelopes as well as printing stamps, stick-'em-based stamps or package envelope. But here's the thing. Because you're using the computer, this could save you a lot of time. If you're an Amazon or an eBay seller, it automatically sucks the information about your buyer right out of the web page and does it. So you don't have to type in addresses or anything. You get discounts the post office won't give you at the post office because they want you, frankly. They want you to use Stamps.com. Up to 21% off express mail, up to 15% off priority mail. If you're doing international mailing, simplifies that, fills out all the forms for you. This is a really great thing. Now, here's that special offer I told you about. All you have to do is visit Stamps.com. Now, you see the $80 offer? No, don't do that. That would be a mistake. Click the microphone. They think we use, like, this weird microphone. And use the offer code TRIANGULATION. We're using that kind of microphone right now. TRIANGULATION. Type that in and say, go. Look at that! $80 went to $110. Because you're going to get more postage coupons, $55 in free postage. You get the digital scale. You just pay shipping and handling for that. $5 supply kit and a four-week trial. We actually have two Stamps.com accounts because we were fighting over the scale. Now we got scales everywhere. Stamps.com. If you're a small business or an individual, in fact, if you do a lot of mailing, it won't even cost you anything. Just go to Stamps.com. You can read about how they subsidize the whole thing if you mail enough. Stamps.com. Use the offer code TRIANGULATION for that $110 bonus offer, including $55 free postage. You got to try it. I think you'll like it. Stamps.com. So how did you come up with the idea? I guess, did Ted approach you and say, do you want to do a talk? And then you had to come up with an idea?
Yeah, I've known Chris Anderson, who's the TED curator, for many, many years. When he was living in San Francisco running Imagine Media, which was the progenitor of IGN, among other things, we became buddies.
Well, you're a principal at IGN.
I was the first outside board member of IGN.
Great.
And Chris and I became buddies. He read Architects of the Web, and he tracked me down through a friend of a friend, which was kind of cool. And he had moved over from the UK. He had started and sold a large magazine publishing company there. He was in his late 30s, I'd say, when he moved to San Francisco and kind of started the same business, another sort of gaming and technology-oriented publishing company called Imagine Media. He read my book and enjoyed it, and we became good friends. He actually was an early investor in Listen, along with Halsey Miner and Ted Wade of Gateway Computer. And so we've just been friends over the years. When he bought TED, I started attending. I love the TED conference. It's an enormous amount of fun. Morgan and I go every year. And then he kind of asked me, he's like, would you be interested in giving, a few minutes on this?
I think it was SOPA. That's scary.
Oh, terrifying.
I mean, that's a scary invitation. Because, you can't say no. But you got 15 minutes.
Five in my case.
Five minutes.
He asked me if I'd give a quick talk, and I said, yes, that sounds a lot better
and
than 18.
And a huge audience.
Yes.
And the standards for a TED Talk
are terrifying.
And how do you get the standards into 5 minutes?
Well, so that was one of the funny things. I thought Chris was doing me a favor by saying 5 minutes
instead of
18.
It's worse.
Well, I think it was Mark Twain. It might be apocryphal, but it said that Mark Twain once said, I'm sorry to write you a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one. Making it that tight was tricky. And he wanted me to say something connected to SOPA and so forth, because the SOPA thing had been just before TED. TED was in February. SOPA was in, blew up in January. So I started with something that was very serious and very, kind of scholarly almost. And Chris gave me fabulous advice. I ran it by him. He's like, Rob, make it funny. He's like, I've read your book. I know you. I've known you for many years. You make very good points, but why don't you make them in a way that's more playful, because you're better at that than you are at being scholarly professor. And that was the best advice. So with that, I sat down and tore up my presentation and did another one, and the result was the talk that has weirdly gone viral.
It's
over 1 million on TED.com, 600,000 or so on YouTube. It is, Chris told me, the third most heavily viewed TED Talk from the most recent conference, which is fabulous. And it's a very playful look at the insanity of copyright laws. And the if you take the absolutely obscene penalties that are applied to the pilfering of a 99-cent object, and the maximum fine is $150,000. Not coincidentally, that's a plot driver in Year Zero as well. But nonetheless, if you take that out to the extreme, you find that you could quite literally put many billions of dollars worth of pirated music on a single $299 iPod Classic.
We got to play a little clip from this, because the part I love the best is basically the industry claiming that more jobs have been lost than there actually are jobs
yes.
in the industry.
That's yes. how bad it's gotten.
there are so many disingenuous claims that are made.
Go ahead, play a little bit of copyright, Matt. This is Rob
Just
Reed's
recently,
TED Talk.
The Motion Picture Association revealed that our economy loses $58 billion a year to copyright theft. Now, rather than just argue about this number, a copyright mathematician will analyze it, and he'll soon discover that this money could stretch from this auditorium all the way across Ocean Boulevard to the Westin, and then to Mars. If we use pennies. Now, this is obviously a powerful, some might say dangerously powerful insight, but it's also a morally important one. Because this isn't just the hypothetical retail value of some pirated movies that we're talking about, but this is actual economic losses. This is the equivalent to the entire American corn crop failing, along with all of our fruit crops, as well as wheat, tobacco, rice, sorghum, whatever sorghum is. Losing sorghum. But identifying the actual losses to the economy is almost impossible to do unless we use copyright math. Now, music revenues are down by about $8 billion a year since Napster first came on the scene. So that's a chunk of what we're looking for. But total movie revenues across theaters, home video, and pay-per-view are up. And TV, satellite, and cable revenues are way up. Other content markets like book publishing and radio are also up. So this small missing chunk here is puzzling. Since the big content markets have grown in line with historic norms, it's not additional growth that piracy has prevented. But copyright math tells us it must therefore be foregone growth in a market that has no historic norms, one that didn't exist in the 90s. What we're looking at here is the insidious cost of ringtone piracy.
See, this is where the Harvard MBA comes in so handy. You can figure this stuff out. You can pause it. I don't want to steal all of the good lines from here, but if you want to see it, go to reid.com, and the video is there. It was so. What was the reaction to this?
Standing
video?
Ovation.
Well, I know that.
Yeah. Did but you get any industry reaction
yeah.
later?
Here's the fascinating thing. So there are a lot of people from the entertainment industry that go to TED, and a lot of tech people. Thus the T, technology, and E, entertainment, in TED. D is design. Anyway, so there were a lot of entertainment people there, and I thought they were going to be angry. The first person that came up to me after I'd given the talk was a very, very prominent, well-known music industry lawyer who just was laughing. He said, that was brilliant. Now, the thing is,
that's because they know it doesn't make
sense.
They
know it, but here's the other thing. There had been so much anger on both sides
right.
and sermonizing.
And nobody had done it this way. Yeah.
And this was just playful.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I took them to task, but I like to think, I think I did, because of the reactions I got afterward were uniformly positive. I did it in a fun and playful and not sermonizing way. And so that was kind of nice. And, of course, the tech folks in the audience really liked it a lot.
However, yeah. the sorghum growers of America are not
very
happy,
upset.
And they've been meaning
well, look,
to talk
I got sorghum
you.
A punchline. How many sorghum jokes are
That's
out
the
there?
First.
All
it's
publicity
definitely the first.
Is good publicity,
exactly.
sorghum growers.
Sorghum as a punchline, precisely.
The book is going to be out soon, and I have a feeling it's going to be a huge success. I'm taking it now. It's my turn.
There's two.
I've got my own. I don't know why.
Yeah. Can I keep this one, or is this
Absolutely.
One your copy? Because I don't want to. Yeah, because I'm dying to read it.
Yeah.
It will be at, and by the way, it's dedicated to Morgan Webb. So that's nice. Or at least I'd like to thank Morgan Webb. Maybe you didn't dedicate it.
Oh, it's dedicated.
Yes, it's
Morgan.
For Morgan. Yeah.
It is for
How's Morgan.
Morgan
doing?
She's doing very well.
We miss
She's
her.
She's getting revved up for E3.
Oh, yeah.
Please
sure
give
she
her
is.
Our
Busy
love.
Time. Yeah.
You, she's just a wonderful person, and I know you know that.
I know that very well.
Do you?
And,
yeah. I just think you would.
Yeah.
And Ashby the dog. Give
and
him
Ashby
my,
the dog.
Ozzy says hi.
Good.
And everybody should go out and buy a copy. By the way, somebody asked, Yes, there is going to be an Audible version, and it's going to be John Hodgman.
John Hodgman, precisely.
How did you score that? Brilliant choice.
John, I know him actually through TED. He spoke at TED a number of years ago, and we became buddies through that. And early on, I actually asked him if he would read a very, very early version of this. In fact, it was a partially written version. And he and a few other people became very good, you know, guides and mentors and so forth, coaches in a sense, as I was writing it. And so he was very aware of the book, and he liked it. He agreed to blurb it. There's a blurb by him on the back cover. And then I decided to sort of go all in, and we were having lunch over Thanksgiving in New York City. And after an appropriate number of drinks, when I figured I had him in the right mood, I asked him if he'd be willing to read the book. And he made not just my day, but my week, my month, by saying, yeah, I'd be thrilled to do that.
Excellent.
Couldn't have a better person.
It's a very dry and deadpan book, and he has got the perfect voice for it.
And in the back, and we don't know yet because have a few missing, but there's playlists for all the protagonists.
Yes.
Music playlists.
Musical playlists.
You can see you really do love music in here.
I'm rabid about it.
Yeah.
And there are actually one of the kind of fun things, and you probably noticed this, there are many, many dozens, probably even hundreds, I didn't count, of hidden music references throughout the text.
Oh.
Like, there'll be parts where people start talking, and you might catch a snippet of a famous lyric in something that somebody says. A lot of chapter titles, most obviously, a lot of chapter titles are song titles, one album title. So there's a whole bunch of fun little Easter eggs that I threw in there.
Has Nick Carter gotten in touch with you?
No, but I certainly hope he reads and enjoys
the
book.
Because the main character is called Nick Carter.
Oh. Yes.
Also, what, Backstreet Boy?
The main
character is not a Backstreet Boy.
Yeah, so
same name.
Slightly more background there. The protagonist is a guy named Nick Carter. I'll back up a little bit. When the aliens realize they're bankrupt, they decide that they need to go to Earth and find somebody who can unwind this enormous political, legal, artistic conundrum that they find themselves in. And they find that the most powerful law firm on Earth is called Carter, Geller, and Marx. Totally made it up. And there's a guy there named Nick Carter. And the aliens aren't necessarily that bright. They're like, perfect. A, we got a Backstreet Boy.
And he's a lawyer.
And not only is he a lawyer, he's founded the most powerful entertainment law company on Earth. So they go right to Nick Carter. Now, of course, Nick Carter is not the Backstreet Boy.
No.
In fact, he hates the Backstreet Boys because he's been teased for his entire adult life about having the name Nick Carter. Also, he can't stand them. He genuinely hates their music. And no, he's not the founder of the firm. He just happens to have the same last name. So this mid-level, you know, kind of low-level lawyer now has 48 hours to unwind the situation while hopefully making a little bit of romantic progress with a hot chick who lives 2 doors down the hall from him.
Oh, I'm glad you threw that in.
Yes.
A little romance.
That's Manda, who has a wonderful playlist.
She
and
does.
A wonderful cat.
A wonderful cat, yes.
Oh,
named Meow House.
I'm still curious about the real story behind the cat.
I am too.
Is there a sequel in the works?
The cat's playlist is a little weird, but okay.
The cat's playlist ends with a hint as to the ambiguity of the cat's origin.
I kept waiting for that shoe to drop.
And a reference to a rare San Francisco band that probably is not on Spotify.
No, the singer actually died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Orphan Work.
Orphan Work. It is up. I found it. I think I found it on MySpace.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh.
I had never heard the song. Are we allowed to say it? Or?
Yeah, it's about cats. Teenage Pussy from Outer Space.
Teenage Pussy from Outer Space.
Yeah, you can say that. Why wouldn't you be able to?
So Meow House's playlist has lots of references to cats. And this is a weird one because it says something about outer space. Don't know.
Will there be a sequel? Was year one. Maybe it could be year negative one.
Yeah, yeah.
Go backwards in time.
I'm very tempted.
You like to write.
I've done a lot of fun things in my work life. And a lot of those fun things were writing books. My first two books. I've never in my life had more fun doing a work thing than I had writing Year Zero. Absolute blast.
I can't wait to read it. It's called Year Zero. It's out soon, but you can pre-order on Amazon. And read about it on Goodreads. There are lots of reviews.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, they did. Actually, what happened was Random House did a small giveaway.
Yeah. Oh,
and this
smart.
Happens of advanced reader editions. And actually, I'll steal a little bit of my own thunder here at readrobread.com. We too will be doing a small giveaway in a short period of time. I think next week, and we'll be giving away. I think it's 25 books. And the recipients will get them almost a month before the book comes out, which is kind of fun.
That's great.
So what they did with Goodreads, though, to go back to that, is Goodreads does often do these things where they get advanced reader editions from the publishers. They give them to their members. And that's great for people like me because some members can start writing reviews and talking about the book early on. And, you know, it's great for Goodreads and their members because they get access to books that aren't yet out. And that's all fun and exciting. Goodreads is a really amazing site. I've always been aware of it, but I've personally really discovered it through this process, and it's an amazing site.
Yeah, I actually like it a lot too.
I've been using it for years.
I've got to get more involved because
they're a local company.
Go through and start filling out what you've read.
Well, I have some stuff. I have an account on there, and I've put some stuff in, but I have to do more.
Yeah.
I need something like where you hold the book up to the webcam.
Exactly.
A QR code.
Yeah. Or just no. You know, there's a. That's all. Just recognize it. That's the book. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for
really
having
appreciate
me.
Yeah, it.
Huge fun.
Yeah. Hope you've enjoyed this edition of Triangulation. We do the show every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. 4 plus 2 is 12. At 7 is 2300 UTC. Like in the middle of the freaking night. But you should watch live, and if you can't, don't worry, because we make all the shows available, audio and video, on our website, twit.tv, or on iTunes, or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us. Who's next week? Do we know?
Andrew Keen.
Andrew Keen. Oh, that'll be fun. The author of The Cult of the Amateur has a new book in which he lambastes all of you internet nitwits.
All you people who do your own culture.
Ugh, how dare you. And that'll be a lot of fun. You might want to tune in for that one live. We'll see you next time. This Week in Radio Tech is up next. Bye-bye.